Hello, it's Friday, January the 22nd. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we'll be talking about Geoffrey Chaucer. Been around since medieval times, seen as the father of English literature by some, but one university wants to get rid of it in favour of, guess what? Decolonised lessons on race, gender and diversity. Here we go again. Also, we're going to be talking about the threats to pubs and restaurants. We're going to be talking to a leading publican who says he's going to shut down his business after 12 years. If it's true, the government are going to keep the shutdown till May on the hospitality industry. But first, is it the possiest idea you've heard yet from the government? A universal £500 payment to people with COVID to slow the spread of the virus at a cost of £450 million a week. How much is this government and this country in debt? So could a £500 payment, a universal £500 payment to people with COVID, slow the spread of the virus? A leaked Department of Health document suggests the idea is one under consideration, but ministers say they've not seen it, and because experts say that the current level of financial support is not working sufficiently because so many low-paid workers can't afford to self-isolate. I'm joined now by Stephen Reicher, who's Professor of Psychology at the University of St Andrews, and he's a member of the SAGE subcommittee, which is advising the government on behavioural science. On the one hand, Professor, I get why they're talking about it, but it's been widely mocked, this idea. What do you make of it?
Well, first of all, let's look at the wider context. We spend £22 billion and more on the test and trace system. But testing and tracing is pointless unless you isolate people. And if people don't isolate, you're basically wasting your £22 billion. The second thing is that levels of self-isolation are very low. Only about 20% of people are fully self-isolating. And that means that we are undermining all the efforts on test and trace. So in financial terms, if people are concerned about the cost of getting people to self-isolate, just think about the cost of not getting people to self-isolate. Now, by and large, when you look at compliance is actually very high. All the figures show it's up about 80-85%. If anything, it's higher than before. Recent studies showed that. And that suggests that the low levels of compliance in this particular area aren't due to lack of motivation or ill will or because people couldn't be bothered. It's for the practical reasons. Now, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office puts out a report doing comparative studies of different countries. And it shows that actually in those countries which, number one, give support, including giving automatic payments, but doing more than that as well, giving hotel accommodation, giving food, giving medicines. In Europe, they'll even walk your dog for you. They have a care package which looks at all the things that are important. So support, a strong community sense, a strong set of social norms favoring isolation and clear monitoring of behavior. Well, where that happens, those are the truly successful countries. So you see it in Taiwan, you see it in South Korea, you see it in Singapore. You also incidentally see it in New York, which is one of the places that will, as I say, walk your dog for you. So the evidence does suggest that it works. And what's more, in those countries, there is very little evidence that people are taking advantage of it or even, as some have suggested, deliberately getting infected in order to get that level of support. Because still, self-isolation isn't something that is pleasant and it's not something that is easy to do. And my final point is this.
Yeah.
Giving people support isn't only critical and important, it has to be timely. Because there's no point if there are lots of barriers to jump through, it takes a long time, because people have got to self-isolate immediately. It's like the test system. A test that comes back after a few days is a pointless test, because by then you'll have been wandering around and infecting other people. And if you erect barriers, and if you make it difficult, then people are less likely to go for it, more likely to delay, and therefore the self-isolation isn't effective. Now, in terms of the present system does provide up to £500 for about 1 in 8 workers. But of those who apply, if you look at the statistics, they show that in many places, over half of people get turned down. And in some places, like Liverpool, 77% of people get turned down. So such a bureaucratic system in many ways undermines the whole point of it. And we're in a public health emergency. We really do need to get people to self-isolate. That's the big hole in our response. And therefore, yes, there are some risks that some people will take advantage of it. But the far greater risk and the far greater problem we've got is people not self-isolating, not getting the support, not even bothering to ask for the support because they don't think they will get it. And we've got to address that.
And what's your view related, if you like, Professor? This week we got the new bans on people coming in. If you fly in from abroad, you have to have had a COVID test 3 days prior. You've got to self-isolate. I've asked ministers every time I speak to them about how many people isolated when they came into Britain from a flight, because the requirement to isolate had been there before. They don't have a clue. They don't know because it's never been properly enforced. Is that part of the problem? The whole point about self-isolation, there's been no attempt to enforce it.
Well, I would say monitor it to start with, because one of the things they do in the successful countries is, in effect, you have an allocated caseworker, right? You have somebody who will assess your needs and who will meet them and look at what all those needs are. And around, all of us have got different needs. I mean, I mentioned dogs, but while it's easy to laugh at that, for many people, dogs are part of their family. And who's going to walk the dog? But more seriously, what if you've got caring responsibility to others? What are you going to do about that? So everybody will have different needs. And it's really important to look at those in the round and to have somebody who you can talk to and who can check in on how you are. Now, that checking in is partly to support you practically. It's partly to help you psychologically, because one of the huge costs of self-isolation is psychological. You need somebody to be in contact to see whether you're okay and how you're doing, somebody to talk to. But on top of that, it seems to me a reasonable deal that if the community looks after you, if it gives those resources and so on, if you've got a right to expect that you actually abide by the self-isolation. And I think, you know, in many ways, people will see that as perfectly legitimate. They see it as perfectly reasonable. But this, in a sense, is a deal that the community looks after people, but people in return are expected strongly to abide by the restrictions and actually to self-isolate.
All right, that's fascinating stuff. That's Stephen Wright, a professor of psychology at the University of St Andrews, who's a member of the SAGE subcommittee advising the government and ministers on behavioural science. With the COVID infection rate falling, albeit slowly, more and more Tory MPs are demanding a timetable for the lifting of COVID restrictions. But the Prime Minister in flood-hit Manchester says it's too early to say when the curbs will end, amid reports that pubs and restaurants may be closed until May, far longer than anybody expected. Schools also are expected to remain closed to most pupils until after Easter. I'm joined now by Tim Foster, who's owner of Yummy Pubs. Tim, your industry has been battered almost to death. Is this the last rites now, closing till May?
Battered to death is the right thing to say. We're just facing an uphill struggle constantly, and that date and that calendar date will not work for me. My business will be gone.
Now, that's really, really sad to hear that, Tim. I mean, how long, when do you need to reopen by to have any prospect of remaining viable?
With the current grants and the system that they've got set up, it's costing me about £15,000 a month to remain as I am. So they're not covering the bills, which is just depleting cash out of my bank account. So we've forecast that we can stay as we are until the end of March. And then if we're not allowed to open and we're not allowed to trade like a full year after we were forced to close initially, then we will have to call it quits, pay all of our suppliers. We made a commitment 12 years ago that we would give it our best and give it a go. And if we were going to walk away from it, we would make sure that we were able to walk away having paid everybody that we owed and literally shake each other's hands, pat each other on the back and walk away. And that's exactly what we will do come the 28th of March. I will have enough in my bank accounts to pay every single supplier, including my local landscapers and gardeners who are currently helping and doing what they can. And then we'll just walk away from the business with sharp shop, and that will be it. 66 jobs gone. business that before COVID was contributing over £1 million a year in taxes to the HMRC and sustaining local economies around all of the pubs. But it'll be the end for us. We just can't sustain it. I've already borrowed a huge amount of money that I'm expected to be able to be paying back in March, and I'm just not going to borrow more. I'm simply not going to keep on borrowing cash for the government to keep me closed and then keep second guessing whether or not I can trade or can't trade. It's an absolute joke. They need to start planning the future for us and at least letting us know what's going on and listening to scientists that are supposedly saying there's going to be peaks. You know, Boris welcomes everybody to go around to each other's houses and have a lovely Christmas. So the guys just got to start getting on with it and understanding what leadership is. And at the moment, there isn't any.
Devastating for you, Tim. That business, you've put your heart and soul, lots of your money into it, your energy, your love, and your love too. I mean, how long have you been running that business?
12 years. Started amazing. In the first recession. I'm currently delivering cocktails across the country. We started a new business, Letterbox Cocktails. And we've been doing thousands and thousands of cocktails in the last 6 days to try and keep cash coming in and keep revenue streams going and to just give our staff an opportunity and a hope for the future. So I'm in Maidstone right now, having just dropped off a parcel to a delightful young lady who's on a Zoom call later on tonight with all of her friends, having lost their dad a week ago. And our Royal Mail parcel force let me down. So I've come out and I've delivered them by hand to all of the ladies that are on the Zoom call because of how important it is to them and how important it is to us. But yeah, this constant, we might open you now and we may open you then, and or you could, you know, be really lucky. They just need to step up with support, Andrew. If they actually genuinely went, you know, like I read on the newspapers today about the £500 for people that got it, if they had done that in the beginning, we wouldn't be in this mess now. You know, they're forcing people to go out on to work that couldn't afford it and trying to cut corners and not spend the money. They're doing exactly the same in hospitality. They started the first week before the pandemic kicked in, just telling everybody, don't bother going to the pub, you know, stay home, mm-hmm. don't worry about it. And then realised that they actually had to pay for it. So they're forcing my businesses to close, not allowing me to do anything and expecting me to sit back and just take it and then, not be able to pay the bills. So, yeah, I'll do everything I can.
How much do you think you spent adapting your hostelries to make them so-called COVID-friendly? What do you think that's cost you?
We didn't spend a great deal of money. We used common sense. So we asked people to, you know, and we did the whole sanitising hands. We created incredibly safe environments. It's more about what's actually cost me in terms of the restrictions they put on us. So this cost well over £1 million with the restrictions that I was forced to trade under. My business normally runs at about £6-7 million across the four sites a year, and we were down in the 3-3.5. So personally, I've suspended my mortgages for the last 6 months. We didn't take a salary for 5 months. I've gone into all of my savings. So personally, it's cost us hundreds of thousands of pounds. But we were prepared to take the hit with everybody else and, you know, and try and save a business that's worth saving before this, you know, incredibly successful, highly awarded business. And I'm not going to give up on it just yet.
All right. Well, look, Tim, the very best of luck to you. We'll talk to you before then. We hope there's rumours that there's going to be another announcement of more support for the hospitality industry. If there is any more money coming, might that be potentially enough to keep you going a bit longer than March 28th?
Yeah, absolutely. They've got to give us the lifeline. Give me the cash now and I'll pay it back. You know, just support me now whilst we need the support and give me decent support. We were there in the first recession. And we helped the country pull out of it. We've supplied 1 in 5 jobs. We will be there again. Customers are desperate to come out. People are desperate to go out. And, you know, and that bent up demand is there. I can drive revenue. I can drive taxes. I can help this country come out of all of this spending. And I will pay back every damn penny within a year in taxes. It will be repaid in full. So it's not dead money that they're just throwing at a sector that we will never come back from. We can help put this country back on its feet and generate some fun and entertainment that people are desperate for.
All right, Tim, best of luck with those hand-delivered cocktails or Royal Mail-delivered cocktails, if they ever get their act together either. But best of luck with that. And Tim, I'm sure we'll speak again. Very best of luck to you. That's Tim Foster, the owner of Yummy Pubs, that is now teetering quite close to the end game. Thanks for joining us. So if you enjoy The Daily Show, subscribe to us. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify, and get in touch by emailing us at dailyshow@mailplus.co.uk or follow us at Mel Plus. So Leicester University has been accused by some of absolute madness over plans to drop Chaucer from its teaching. The Education Secretary Gavin Williamson said the university should stop the move to abandon medieval English studies in favour of what is called a decolonised curriculum of studies in race, gender and diversity. But are Chaucer's Canterbury Tales still relevant? I'm joined now by Dr. Christine Rao, who's reader in medieval English literature at the University of St. Andrews. Christine, you said I can call you by your first name. Why do you think Chaucer is still relevant all these centuries after he wrote the Canterbury Tales, which of course was his most famous story about pilgrims on their way to visit that shrine?
I think Chaucer is still relevant, but not just Chaucer. I mean, you get a lot of medieval authors, and I think we ought to keep reading them for all sorts of different reasons. I mean, people come at medieval literature for all sorts of different reasons. I mean, some people might be interested in the history of the English language. Some people might be interested in history and in the history of their country or their heritage. Some people might just be interested in literature and stories, and they want to read stories about all the things that literature is about, like love and warfare and worries and sex and religion. And medieval literature is about those things in the same way as modern literature. So I would say medieval literature gives us an idea of where we come from, for a start. I think it's important to engage with older cultures, people who came before us, in the same way as you, for instance, you don't just talk to young people these days, you talk to old people too. We want our young people to be good at talking to old people too. And the same way with literature, therefore, we want to be able to engage with current authors, but also we want to be able to talk across the centuries, basically, with older authors. They're not boring and stuffy, and I think it's worth trying out.
Well, I mean, I can remember Chaucer from my A-level English many, 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 many decades ago, Christine. And there were stories like The Wife of Bath, all these stories. Now, as I recall them, they were rather naughty. Some would say risque, poetic. Some might even say crude. They were colourful, at least, you would say, not boring by any stretch of the imagination.
I suppose when we teach medieval literature, whether that's at school or at university, you know, we have to take a pick. Which stories do we pick? And I suppose teachers of medieval literature, we pick the stories that we think the students might like. And so we tend to go for the racy stuff or the stuff that might get young people excited. But medieval literature is as varied as any other literature. Some of it is boring, some of it is serious, some of it is sad, some of it is funny. So, and in fact, Chaucer is a good example. Chaucer, if you read across his entire oeuvre, his entire sort of all his writings, he did all sorts of different things. So reading a bit around in the Canterbury Tales actually gives you a pretty good idea what sort of how varied medieval literature is.
And don't some people say actually that Chaucer is the so-called father of English literature, which puts him up there as a really, really significant figure in the development of the English language?
I suppose you could call him the father in the sense that he's been read continuously ever since he lived. So there was probably never a time when Chaucer wasn't read. So that makes him sort of one of the people who's been around for longest. But there were other influential authors that are not so famous. One interesting thing about Chaucer is that we know quite a bit about him as a person. So that's not true for all medieval authors. With some other medieval authors, we hardly know their name. We hardly know where they lived within what is now the UK. We don't know anything about their views beyond what you can read in their text. But with Chaucer, we know quite a bit about his biography, and we've recently worked out quite a bit more about it. So we know a lot more about his job, what he did for work, where he travelled, which other people he dealt with. I suppose for people who are interested in history primarily, reading Chaucer is interesting because you can sort of compare his own biography with the writings that he produced. So that makes Chaucer a bit special, I suppose.
And just finally, the Leicester University are insisting this is nothing to do with getting rid of Chaucer because it's too white. They want to, they say, offer undergraduate degrees that provide differences, and they set out a selection of models on race, ethnicity, sexuality and diversity, a decolonised curriculum and new employability modules. I don't see the word literature anywhere in any of that.
Yeah, that's sad, isn't it? I mean, to be honest, I don't know too much about what's going on at the University of Leicester, but I can promise you that the people who currently teach Chaucer and other medieval literature, they're very modern. They teach this in a very modern way. It's not fair to suggest that medieval literature is not about race and diversity and sexuality. It is definitely about all of these things. So by keeping Chaucer and medieval literature alive and by getting young people to engage with it or giving them the chance to engage with it, you get them to engage exactly with modern topics like sexuality and class and that kind of thing. So I think that's a bit of a red herring of people to say that we need to get rid of earlier older literature because we need to focus on modern stuff. The older literature that we teach these days is taught in a modern way and gets people sort of to compare old literature and modern literature. Another point I'd like to make, if I may, is we need to have a think about where we're going to be in 1,000 years' time. The people who live in 1,000 years' time,
yes,
do we want them to take an interest in us? Do we want them to look back on the 21st century? Or do we want them to think, oh, that the people in the 21st century are all stuffy and boring? No, we don't want that. We're not stuffy and boring now, and we want to, communicate, I suppose, across the centuries with people, and that means that we need to engage with earlier centuries, and then also we want later centuries to engage with us. I suppose literature is one way of doing it. History is another one, so we need to find out a bit more about history and literature. And when it comes to sort of teaching young people about all these things, whether that's in schools or in universities, I would say, I would say to young people, try out as many different things as you like. I mean, try out new foods, try out new sports. In that sense, I'd say try out new literature, read stuff that you haven't read. And medieval literature, I think, is very good in that respect. It gives people sort of a perspective that they might not have come across before. And that's the appeal that medieval literature has for me, I suppose.
Well, you make your case very well, Doctor. That's Dr. Christine Rauch. She's reader in medieval English literature at the University of St. Andrews in defence of Geoffrey Chaucer and other great medieval writers. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's here. More upheaval in that Premier League. This really is turning out to be, Matt, a season of unexpected results. Liverpool, you told me last week, were impregnable at Anfield, and they then drew 0-0 bore of the year result to Manchester United, and now they've lost at home to Burnley, who I didn't even know, to be honest, were in the Premier League.
Well, yes, they certainly are, and yeah, you're right, Anfield had been impregnable. It's coming up to 4 years since they've lost at home, 68 games, that's 1,369 days.
Is that a record, Matt? Is that a record, relatively? Must be up there,
I suppose. I mean, it would be a club record for Liverpool, but whether any other club have beaten that, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but it's certainly an incredibly long time, so I wouldn't be surprised if it is. 4 years, it's a remarkably long time to have not been beaten at home. And then who'd have thought that it would be Burnley who'd end that run, maybe Man U or Man City, but but the fact that it was Burnley, it's just a sign that Liverpool are terribly off form, which is so bizarre because I think we spoke about it the other day. It was only about a month ago they beat Crystal Palace 7-0. Since then, they haven't scored in four games. They scored one after that 7-0, but they haven't scored in the last four games. All been goalless. So. Really has. The wheels have come off, or as Jurgen Klopp poetically described it yesterday after the game, the flower that they had has been stamped on. So they're now down to fourth. They could be seventh by the time they next play. And it really is a sort of rapid and bizarre fall from grace for the champions. So we'll see what happens. They play Man U again at the weekend as well.
Oh, well, that'll be interesting. Now, the Olympics, what's going on with them?
Well, it's just getting increasingly hard to see that the Olympics are going to go ahead in Japan this summer.
Yeah, no chance.
Well, I mean, that's the feeling. They're so desperate not to call it off. But there's reports now that fans won't be allowed to attend. Well, you've got to ask yourself, if fans aren't going, what's in it for Japan? Why would they invite people from all over the world, all these different countries, to come to Japan And to have the Olympic Games when there's no income for the, you know, for the organisers because there's no tickets being sold, and all the other income that comes with it, the hotels, the merchandise, you know, et cetera, the restaurants, blah, blah, blah. Why would they do it? So, you know, if there's no fans, I just can't see it going ahead. And you know, given where we're at, you know, the prospect of fans being allowed to travel, it just is feeling increasingly unlikely that the whole thing will happen, which is obviously, you know, a real shame. And I don't think they'll put it back. We'll just have to go down as having, you know, no Olympic Games. So it's just, yeah, a real shame. But it's hard to see any other solution.
That would be particularly bad for those athletes, Matt, who for them it's probably their last chance of gold, silver or bronze, or even their last chance to represent their country.
Yeah, and you know, these people, these athletes, they train for sort of on 4-year cycles, you know, with their training targeted very much around these, you know, these events. So if you're an athlete, you're right, who's been building up to this for the last 3 years, and then then it's put back a year and you think, okay, well, I can deal with that, you know. And then it doesn't happen at all. Yeah, I mean, you know, all those hours that you've put in, all those early mornings, getting up, going to the gym, doing whatever it is that you do, would feel obviously wasted. So, yeah, really sad.
And just finally, Matt, you predicted it would be harder work against Sri Lanka in the second test, and that prediction's come right, unlike your football ones.
Well, yeah, England has done well, but Sri Lanka have fought back in this test so far. We've had day one. Sri Lanka closed day one on 230 for 4, so not a high-scoring day's cricket. One for the purist rather than the occasional watcher, I'd suggest. But the story of the day was undoubtedly Jimmy Anderson, who came back into the England team having been rested for the first test. He's 38 now, so he's nearly your age, and 38, and he took three of the four wickets to fall. So a remarkable performance by the evergreen Jimmy Anderson, Benjamin Button, they're calling him. 19 overs he bowled today, 10 maidens, 3 for 24 runs. So a brilliant performance from him, but a tough day for England.
All right, Matt. That's Matt Gatwood, the Deputy Sports Editor with the latest sports news. He'll be back with us next week. So a lot of us are stuck at home for hours on end because of COVID. So what sort of mess is the house in? And could tidying the house help you to reduce stress levels? Because when Diana Spellman lost her income because of COVID-19, she took it as an opportunity to launch her own business. And it's all about helping people to deal with mess stress. And she's designed her own simple, serenely sorted system. And she joins me now. Diana, just tell us briefly why COVID-19 meant you lost your income.
Yes, well, I was working in the corporate world and I had a contract. I worked in the corporate world for 25 years in various roles, but happened to be contracting for the last 4 years working from home. And as you can imagine, contracts tend to disappear.
Dried up.
First. So that's what happened. But actually, it was really an opportunity for me to work on my passion, which I've been kind of working on for the past several years already as a sort of side hustle, if you like.
And that passion is organising messes at home, or is it just that in the home, or could it be a mess in the office?
It could be both. And of course, right now, they are both, aren't they? They're both at home.
Yeah.
And it really all came about because I worked from home for the past 4 years, as I said, and I developed what I now call mess stress because, you know, when you're at home, you can see all the piles building up around you. And as a naturally messy person sort of inside, you know, this was happening to me. And I really resented the time I spent tidying constantly at weekends in my free time. Because actually for me, tidying was a drudgery and I wanted to do less of it.
So what is serenely sorted?
Well, it's a unique and simple but not simplistic system that helps you get tidy and stay tidy in your home for life, basically. It's also really realistic. I don't know about you, but on social media these days, you really see a lot of kind of the perfect kind of home that you're supposed to aspire to. And I wanted to give people something, and also for myself, a way of keeping tidy at home, but spending less time doing it. And this kind of stems from my corporate background, which is all in systems and process automation, and wanted to do it more efficiently. So spend less time doing it than ever before, but still have a great looking home. And the system gives you some very simple but highly effective ways of doing that throughout your home and organizing in a such a way that you can, spend less time tidying, but really have that time to relax in the evening. And I think this is why it's so important for lockdown right now is, you know, we need that moment in the evening, just a little bit of time for ourselves to relax.
So do you have a few ideas of how you change this mindset so that you're not spending all day? I mean, there might be kids in the house too, a pet as well. A messy husband might be working from home, or a messy wife might be working from home. Let's not be sexist here. How someone listening to this thinking, oh my God, this woman's got the holy grail, the answer here. What are just one or two perhaps of the practical steps you would take?
Yes. So for me, it's all about the daily debris, which is what I call that stuff that's lying on your kind of sideboard and all your services at home. And if we can reduce that just a little bit of a time, then we can, you know, not be triggered by what's on there, because that's kind of what causes that mess stress is that, you know, work from home stuff still sitting there or the homeschool sitting there. So what I would do is just start to try and rid three of those mess makers from your surface. And the way to do this is you have to create what I call end homes for them. And if you allocate just three today, an end home for three of those things on your surface, and make sure that you mindfully put those things back to their end homes at the end of today, you will begin to see a more serene space. And then you can just gradually add to it. And like I do now, my surfaces are always clear in the evening, but it doesn't even feel like tidying because my mindset and behavior is just returning things to those end homes. And, you know, it just happens super fast for me now. And it really is possible to feel serene then in the evening.
And do you always remember where the end home is?
Yes. And people will ask, well, what about the partner in the home? Can they remember too? And it's, of course, about agreeing that together. And, you know, for us right now in homeschooling, the funny thing is that the pencil sharpener becomes an extremely important commodity at home. And we've agreed where exactly that goes so that everyone can find it. And it always gets put back there, like the pencils, the craft stuff, the work from home stuff, the homeschooling stuff. It all has a place to go and gets put back to its end home at night, so it's all clear so that you can sit in the evening and enjoy that glass of wine or cup of tea or whatever and feel that serene. And that's obviously why I've called my business that very name, is because that's the feeling I want people to have.
And you've been running serenely sorted soirees. I like the alliteration on the S here, with clients from your home, because you've taken this whole system online, obviously.
Yes, I did do these soirees at home initially, like, within my home. Think Tupperware party, but for home organisation. And now I people can learn the system online, either via my video-based courses, purely online, or my Serenely Sorted Academy with the next one starts in March, where you can be fully immersed and really transform your life and home through learning the system.
If your husband leaves something on the work surface, do you shout at him?
Well, the thing is, it's probably me. Being the naturally messy person in the house, it was always me, which is why I decided to do something about it. And because of my corporate skills, really managed to find a way. He is actually the more tidy one. So, but everyone's relationship's different, and you know, that's this does work best, and I always find it works best with the carrot approach rather than the stick. So, you know, he's really bought into the system because he can see how it's helped me and helped our home for the better. So, you know, he's happy to be end homing stuff as well now too.
Very interesting. Serenely Sorted. If you wanted to find it on the find your website, Diana, is it just www.serenelysorted?
Yeah.com, yes. And people can download a free guide as well. It's like a magazine article you can read, you know, and I also have a Facebook community, which is a free community where I share tips all the time as well. So there's plenty people can do to take it a little bit step further if they want to.
Sounds great. That's Diana Spellman from Serenely Sorted. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, why don't you download the Mail Plus app? Every weekday at 5 p.m, listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show. I'll be back on Monday. Have yourselves a very good weekend and good night.